Welcome back, everyone. We're diving deep into India's journey from being under colonial rule to modern independence.
It's a huge period we're looking at.
It is, from about 1857 to today. And we're not just using history books.
Oh, no.
We've got scholarly stuff, but also personal stories.
Right.
And even some architecture.
Architecture can be so revealing, you know, it can really show us how power dynamics and cultures changed. I'm excited to see what we find there.
Yeah, me too. But to start us off, I found this really interesting fact. So for a time, the East India Company actually said they recognized the Mughal emperor's power.
Really?
Yeah. They even put his image on their coins.
Wow. That's a perfect example of how the British had to, like, balance things back then. They had to seem legit.
Right.
But at the same time, they were taking control.
It's like they were trying to sneak in, but their goals were way too big for that. And speaking of big goals, 1772 is a key year.
Why is that?
That's when Warren Hastings became the first Governor General for the East India Company's territories.
Oh, right. Hastings. He had to set up a whole government for British India. Can you imagine trying to do that in a place with totally different culture, languages, customs? It must have been crazy difficult.
It makes you wonder if some of what he did was actually more like how India already did things. I saw in some sources that historians debate about whether the British actually imposed a completely new system.
Or just kind of adapted to what was already there.
Exactly. And then on top of all that, you have the East India Company being controlled more and more by the British Crown. It's like they're running a puppet show with two sets of strings.
Yeah. The regulating acts, they started in the 1770s. They were all about controlling what the company did. And eventually it led to the Government of India Act of 1858.
Which basically gave all the power to the crown.
Yep. The British government wanted to be totally in charge of their colony.
It makes you think maybe that control played a part in all the tension that exploded in the 1857 Sepoy Mutiny.
Oh, the mutiny was definitely a turning point. It showed that British rule was kind of fragile.
And that people were ready to fight back.
Right. But I think even more important, it made Indians start to feel a shared national identity.
So it wasn't just a military thing, but like a spark for a much bigger movement.
Yeah, exactly. It shifted the whole conversation from local resistance to this unified fight for independence. And that's when we start seeing the people and groups that would change everything for India.
Like the Indian National Congress, formed in 1885, what I found fascinating is they didn't immediately demand full independence.
Oh, yeah. At first, they were focused on reforms.
Within the existing system.
Right. Like Dadabhai Nauroji and Gopal Krishna Gokhale, they thought working with the British was the way to get change slowly.
More representation for Indians, a fairer share of the power.
But from the sources, it seems not everyone agreed with that approach.
Yeah, there was a growing group in the Congress who wanted something more radical.
Oh, yeah. People like Bal Gangadhar Tilak and Lala Lajpat Rai, they were seen as extremists.
They wanted complete independence now.
And they weren't afraid to be more forceful about it.
They believed real freedom meant going head-to-head with the British.
Absolutely. So even within the movement for independence, you see this split.
Between slow reform and demanding everything right away.
And that debate shaped how things went for decades. But on both sides, they all wanted the same thing, to decide their own future and get rid of colonial rule.
It's amazing to think about the challenges they faced going up against the whole British Empire.
And the British Raj was really powerful. Even with some concessions, they didn't really want to give up any real power.
And the sources show how they often made things worse by playing up existing divisions within India.
Yeah, like to maintain their control.
Right.
The Morley-Minto reforms in 1909 are a great example. They made separate elections for Muslims, supposedly to ensure they had representation.
But it really just divided people more.
Oh, yeah. It deepened the religious and communal rifts. It was almost like setting the stage for future conflicts.
It's like they were playing a dangerous game, using those differences to hold on to power.
And as we move into the 20th century, we see these internal divisions and global events like World War I making India's fight for independence even more complicated. But that's a story for part two.
It's amazing how things happening so far away can change the course of a whole nation.
Yeah, like World War I. It really shook things up for India and its fight for independence.
I know, right? It exposed some of the messed up stuff about British imperialism.
Totally. Like, here they were fighting for freedom and democracy in Europe.
But denying those same rights to Indians.
Exactly. And think about all the Indians who were sent to fight for the British Empire. Millions of them served in the war.
often in really tough conditions.
Absolutely. And they rarely got any recognition for it. It's a stark reminder of how much colonialism cost people, you know, the human cost.
And beyond the moral issues, the war also created new economic and political problems within India.
Problems.
Well, I guess problems and also opportunities. The sources mentioned how demand for Indian goods and raw materials went up during the war.
Oh, right, because of the war effort.
So there was some economic growth. But it seems like not everyone benefited equally.
You're right. Some did really well, certain sectors, certain individuals, but others were left behind.
And that uneven development just added to the existing social and economic tensions.
It's true. And it's in this crazy mix of global conflict and internal turmoil that we see a really important figure emerge, Mahatma Gandhi.
Gandhi. He really changed everything.
His arrival was a total turning point. His whole philosophy of satyagraha, nonviolent resistance, it really caught people's attention.
Millions of people.
It wasn't just the nonviolence itself, though. It was that it was rooted in Indian traditions. That's what resonated with people.
One source described satyagraha as like a moral force, challenging the whole basis of British rule.
I like that. It wasn't just about protesting. It was about changing hearts and minds.
And the British, with their reliance on force and authority, they had no idea how to handle this kind of resistance.
Not at all. And Gandhi's movements, like the non-cooperation movement in the early 1920s and the civil disobedience movement 10 years later, they got so many Indians involved.
Like a huge number of people.
It wasn't just elites debating anymore. It was everyday folks. Farmers, students, shopkeepers, everyone was taking part in the struggle.
They boycotted British goods, refused to pay taxes, and challenged laws, but peacefully.
Right.
It's incredible how Gandhi brought so many different people together.
It is.
All under one banner. The sources really emphasize how he crossed religious, caste, and regional lines.
His message was about self-reliance, truth, and justice. And people from all walks of life connected with that. Plus, his own sacrifices going to jail for what he believed in, that made him even more respected.
But even with Gandhi, things weren't easy. There were setbacks, disagreements within the movement, and times of awful violence.
And the British government still wouldn't budge on giving full independence. The Cripps Mission in 1942, for example.
They offered dominion status, but only after the war.
And many Indians saw it as too little, too late.
The Congress, led by Gandhi and Nehru, they wanted self-rule right away. But the Muslim League, under Jinnah, they saw a chance to push for their own separate Muslim state. So even with World War II going on, the divisions within India were getting deeper.
The Quit India movement that the Congress started in 1942 was a huge turning point. They called for the British to leave immediately.
And the British responded brutally.
Oh, yeah. Thousands were in prison and the movement was basically crushed.
But even though it was suppressed, it showed that British rule was coming to an end.
It did. It showed how much people wanted independence. And it proved that the British couldn't rule India anymore if people didn't want them to.
And finally, in 1947, independence came. But we know it came with a huge cost. Partition.
And the creation of Pakistan.
Partition was a terrible tragedy. So many people were displaced. So many lives lost in the violence that followed.
A dark chapter for sure, and one that still affects the region today.
It reminds us how much division can hurt and how colonial policies can have long-lasting consequences.
But amidst all that chaos, a new nation was born.
And with independence came a whole new set of challenges, creating a nation from nothing.
Integrating princely states. Writing a constitution, and all while dealing with the trauma of partition.
It's overwhelming to think about. How do they even begin to tackle all that?
Well, the Indian constitution was definitely key. It's a remarkable achievement, a testament to the vision and dedication of the people who wrote it.
Some sources call it the longest written constitution in the world.
Which makes sense, given how diverse and complex Indian society is.
It wasn't just a legal document, though.
Oh, it was way more than that. It was a statement of values, a blueprint for this new India.
It laid out fundamental rights, guaranteed everyone the right to vote.
And aimed to create a secular democratic republic. A huge shift from India's past.
And Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, he had a big part in shaping this new nation.
Nehru was an interesting guy. He was influenced by both Western ideas and India's own traditions. He wanted a modern, secular, and democratic India.
With a focus on social justice and economic growth.
Right. The sources highlight his commitment to building a strong, independent nation that could hold its own on the world stage.
And he went for that vision with ambitious policies and some very practical compromises.
Absolutely.
One of those policies that really stands out is the Green Revolution in the 1960s.
Which was all about transforming India's agriculture.
And becoming self-sufficient in food.
It had a lot of success, increasing crop yields and tackling food shortages. But like a lot of big projects, the benefits weren't shared equally.
Some areas did better than others.
Those with better resources and infrastructure. So that uneven development, that gap between progress and inequality, it's a theme that keeps coming up in India's story.
And what about the politics? We talk about how the Congress party was dominant for a while, but things have become much more divided, haven't they?
They have. Regional parties representing different language or ethnic groups changed things. Now we see more coalition governments, which means more negotiating and compromising between different political groups.
And of course, there's Indira Gandhi.
Her time in power was something else.
It was a turbulent period.
Definitely. She was a strong leader, no doubt. Decisive during the 1971 war with Pakistan, focused on social welfare programs. But then there was the emergency.
Yeah, from 1975 to 1977, when she basically shut down democratic rights and ruled with an iron fist.
A dark period in India's democratic history.
It shows how even the strongest democracies can slip into authoritarianism, especially when things get tough.
That's true. And it makes you think about the balance between individual freedoms and national security is something democracies all over the world are still figuring out.
So thinking about India's journey from colonial times to now, what stands out to you the most? So we're back for our last look at India's journey to independence and beyond. And in this part, I'm really curious about the whole nation building thing. Like right when India became independent, it felt like they had to figure out some really big questions about who they were and where they were going.
Absolutely. Think about it. They were coming out of centuries of colonial rule with a society that was so divided, religion, caste, language. And then you throw in partition on top of that. Millions of people displaced, violence everywhere. It's a recipe for some serious challenges.
It's like trying to build a house, but the foundation keeps moving. How did they even survive those early years, let alone thrive?
Well, a lot of the sources point to the Indian Constitution. It's this incredible document that manages to capture both how complex India is and what its people want.
I'm fascinated by all the debates that happened when they were making it. Like, did everyone agree on what kind of nation India should be?
Oh, it was anything but smooth. There were figures like B.R. Ambedkar, a real champion for social justice. He fought so hard to make sure the Constitution addressed the needs of marginalized communities. He wanted equality and fairness written right into it.
So the Constitution was more than just laws. It was about values, about a vision for a new and better India.
Exactly. It laid out the foundation for a secular, democratic republic. Everyone having fundamental rights, everyone getting to vote. It was a clean break from the colonial past, a chance to build a more just and equitable society.
And Nehru, as the first prime minister, he had to take those ideals and make them real.
Nehru is such a complex figure. The sources show him as someone deeply influenced by Western ideas, but also deeply connected to India's heritage. He wanted India to be modern, but without losing its soul.
I noticed how much Nehru believed in science and technology as tools for building the nation.
He saw them as crucial for progress, lifting India out of poverty, giving them a place on the world stage. That's why he put so much into education, research, infrastructure.
But it wasn't just about that, right? There were also social and economic programs, like the Green Revolution.
The Green Revolution was a perfect example of Nehru's approach. He knew they had to solve the food problem, and he saw technology as the key to becoming self-sufficient.
But like we talked about before, the Green Revolution also had a downside. The benefits weren't always spread evenly, so you still see these gaps between regions and communities.
That's a key point. It shows this ongoing tension in India's story, progress and inequality going hand in hand. The economy grows, but there's still a huge gap between rich and poor, urban and rural.
And politically. We discussed the Congress party being in charge for a while. But it seems like things have become much more divided.
Definitely. Regional parties representing different groups started to change things. Now you have coalition governments, which means power sharing. It's a much more complex system.
And then there's Indira Gandhi. Her time in power was pretty intense.
Indira Gandhi was a force of nature. She wasn't afraid to make tough decisions, like in the 1971 war with Pakistan. And she pushed for social welfare programs. But then there was the emergency.
Yeah, when she basically suspended democracy and took over.
It was a dark time for India's democracy.
It's a reminder that even in strong democracies, there's always a risk of falling into authoritarianism, especially when things get really bad.
And it raises those difficult questions about how to balance individual freedoms with national security. Questions that democracies everywhere are still wrestling with.
So as we wrap up this whole deep dive, what are some of the big takeaways for our listeners? What can we learn from India's amazing journey?
I think one of the biggest lessons is just how resilient people can be. India went through so much: colonialism, partition, poverty, social divisions. But they didn't just survive, they thrived. It shows you the power of believing in something better, the will to overcome anything.
It's also a story of constant change, a nation adapting to new challenges and making its own future.
And maybe most importantly, it's not over. India today is a global power, a democracy full of energy and potential, but they're still working on things: inequality, the environment, making a more just society for everyone.
So as we leave our listeners to think about all this, what's one last thought you'd leave them with?
I'd say, don't just see India's story as history. See it as a source of inspiration and a way to understand things better. Progress isn't a straight line. There are bumps along the way. But people, with their hope, their creativity, their resilience, they can overcome anything.
That's a great way to put it. And with that, we come to the end of our deep dive into India's journey from colonial rule to today. It's been a look at a nation fighting for its own destiny, the hard work of building a nation, and the amazing strength of the human spirit.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. We hope this sparked your curiosity to learn even more about this incredible country and its story.
And remember, history isn't just about the past. It's about understanding where we are now and where we're headed. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep learning.